God and power, religion and politics. That's, I think, the core of the book of Shmuel. What is our relationship with God not supposed to look like? And what is our relationship with God supposed to look like? Shaul hears from Shmuel that it's over. His power is going to be taken away from him. His son will not inherit his power. His lineage is cut out. The monarchy is now moving to the hands of someone else. Who is that someone else? He hears three words that will describe him. Re'echa hatov mimcha. Re'echa means someone very close to you. Tov mimcha means someone that's better than you. I could only imagine, it's hard to imagine, what's going on now inside the mind, inside the head of Shaul. Re'echa hatov mimcha. Who's close to me that's better than me? That's the paranoia, that's what is planting in his mind. He doesn't know who it is, but that paranoia creates damage. And very quickly he has mood swings. He gets depressed. He has very quick mood swings. So the people around Shaul say, the best way to take care of his mood swings, of his dark moments, his dark hours, is for him to listen to great music. Because, and they're right, by the way, music has a calming effect on our moods. Music could shift our moods. We need a talented musician that could shape his mood, that could keep his mood balanced. And they find a talented musician. And that talented musician is David. So now the readers know something interesting and ironic is going on. David, the metaphysical reason that he has dark moments, he's the guy that could play his guitar, whatever it is he plays, that could end those dark moments. So the reason for his dark moments is also the solution, the answer, the cure to his dark moments. And then, in one of the next scenes, Shaul notices that the guy that's confronting the Philistine, Goliath, and bringing him down is his private musician. By the way, he doesn't even recognize him in the beginning. It's complicated. But Shaul realizes, and the readers realize, that the musician and the warrior are the same person. Now, Shaul fell in love with David. It says that he thought that he loves him. But after the victory on Goliath, also Yonatan, the son of Shaul, falls in love with David. Also, Michal, the daughter of Shaul, falls in love with David. And later on, all the people of Israel will be captured by the charm of the musician warrior. And Shaul is, everything is fine. Until they come, there's the parade where they dance in front of Shaul and David, I guess. And they sing, Hikas Shaul be'alafav, v'David be'alavotav. That Shaul killed thousands. That's one interpretation. David, 10,000s. Now, what's important is not what they're singing. What's important is what Shaul, in his mind, is hearing. And I think this is what he's hearing. When he's hearing, Hikas Shaul be'alafav, v'David be'rvevotav. I think this is what he's hearing. They're hearing, David is better than Shaul. David is better than Shaul. Shaul's achievement is thousands. David's is tens of thousands. David is better than Shaul. And when he hears David is better than Shaul, what does he hear? Re'echa hatov mimcha. Re'echa hatov mimcha. David, that is his re'a, his personal, private musician therapist. Musician therapist is in charge of giving him a good mood. He is the re'echa. He's close to him. And everybody is singing. He is tov mimcha. He realizes, this is it. This is the person. This is the re'echa tov mimcha. And then the chase begins and the obsession, which you cannot calm, bursts out. And this is another reading and another insight into the obsession of Shaul. When he tries, when he does everything he can to kill David, and there is nothing that could stop him, and if priests will hide him, he'll kill the priest, whatever it takes to kill David, what is he actually trying to kill? I think he's trying to kill the prophecy. By killing David, he's killing the Re'echa Tov Mimcha, and therefore the kingdom will stay in his hands. The kingdom is moving to someone else, but if he destroys someone else, the kingdom will stay. So he will stay with him. So when he's chasing David, he's not chasing, he is running away. David is running away from Shaul, but Shaul is trying to run away from the prophecy. So it's about the prophecy. It's the destruction of David will lead to the liberation of Shaul from the prophecy, because it will be destruction of the prophecy. What really happens? His attempt to escape the prophecy will lead Shaul to do horrifying things that we've discussed, I think, a few times already. Why does he kill all the priests of Nov? He's sending a message to all the cities, all the towns throughout ancient Israel. Anyone that gives refuge to David will be destroyed. By the way, everyone got the memo. How do I know? David goes to a town called Keilah in the southwest of Israel, around where Kiryat Gat is today, if you know where Kiryat Gat is. He goes to Keilah, saves Keilah. And the people of Keilah want to hand him in to Shaul. He goes to Zif. The people of Zif call Shaul. They tattletale. They tell Shaul, David is among us. Everyone got the memo. No one wants to give David refuge. It worked. But it also backfired. How does it backfire? Well, before Shaul started chasing David with this passionate obsession, no one thought that David is going to inherit the power of Shaul. It was obvious to everyone that Shaul is the king, and Yonatan, which, by the way, was loved by the people. He's also a warrior, admired by the people. People adore Yonatan for good reasons. He's a tremendous figure. When I was planning these sessions, I thought to have a whole session about Yonatan. But in my own editing, it didn't cut it. So Yonatan was supposed to inherit Shaul, and the people accepted the fact and they admired Yonatan. No one thought that David, this shepherd from Bethlehem, that they liked, they didn't think he's going to replace Shaul. You know when they started thinking he might replace Shaul? And the myth of David starts growing. People start speaking throughout the book about David as the next king instead of Shaul and instead of Shaul's dynasty. Only after Shaul starts chasing him. Because now Shaul is sending out a message. My nemesis is David. The threat to my kingdom is David. And people hear that and they say, hey, his nemesis is David. The threat to his kingdom is David. The alternative to Shaul is David. There's a point here. Everything Shaul does to bring David down lifts David up. And everything Shaul does to protect his power leads to self-destruction and to the loss of his power. For example, Shaul wants to get rid of David. So he gives him a role as a general in his army, sending him to very dangerous missions in the Philistines. He does that because he hoped David will die. David doesn't die. He becomes even more popular. And we'll hear, even in Shmuel Bet, people of Avnel saying, we miss David. He used to be our general. He should be our king. Again, everything that Shaul does in order to destroy David and to bring David down lifts David up. Because what's happening here is that Shaul is trying to escape the prophecy. But everything he does to escape the prophecy turns the prophecy into a reality. His attempt to avoid the fulfillment of the prophecy leads to the fulfillment of the prophecy. This dynamic, the dynamic where Shaul does not accept the prophecy, but is trying to fight the prophecy, and his attempt to fight the prophecy leads to the fulfillment of the prophecy, this dynamic I want to ask you to keep in mind. We'll compare this in the end of David. So keep this dynamic in mind, that everything he does to escape the prophecy leads to the fulfillment of the prophecy. Those actions lead to that. And with that, I want to move to focus on David, and let's capture the archetypical moment of David. When David stands in front of Goliath, now I know how we all see that image. There's a power gap. It's asymmetric warfare. Goliath, he's a giant. David seems kind of small. Goliath has shield and arms. And he's a, he has defense. He has iron on his body. He's defended. David is exposed. He has nothing to defend him. Goliath has a big sword. David has a slingshot. So it seems like Goliath is armed. David is not. Goliath, it seems like it's asymmetric warfare. But that's not how David sees it. David sees it differently. David looks at Goliath. He doesn't see someone that's protected. He sees someone that's heavy. He looks at himself, and he doesn't see someone that's exposed and unprotected. He sees someone that's elastic and quick. This will be a key to understand how David sees the world. He sees the strength of his enemy as the weakness of the enemy. And he sees his own weakness as his strength. And with that in mind, it's played out the following way. When David has that slingshot, there's something you should all know. In biblical times, carrying a slingshot was a lethal weapon. It was actually an ancient profession. In the book of Judges, it's described that among the tribe of Benjamin, it was a profession, and they were so accurate with a slingshot, they could shoot down, they could cut a hair. I don't have much of it, but like I can't even show you one. But a hair from a distance. That's how accurate people that use a slingshot with rocks, how they could be. So let's think about this again. Goliath has a sword. David has a slingshot. The sword only works from close proximity. It has to be very, very close. A slingshot, you could take someone down, if you're good at it, from far. I want to ask, who really has the advantage in this battle of David versus Goliath? So here's how it's described. I don't have enough time to read this, but it's very, very powerful. The first thing you see about David is that he starts, Goliath asks him, where's your weapon? You think I'm a dog? Do you have sticks? It seems like he's hiding the slingshot. There is a moment of deception here. Robert Alter says, and then David starts running, and he's giving Goliath the illusion that he's running towards him. They'll have they'll be in close proximity where Goliath could use his sword, because Goliath asks him, where is your sword? David knows something that Goliath doesn't. He starts running, and then he stops. He takes a slingshot, and he knocks him down. Now this is a moment, textually it's problematic, because here's what it says. It says, the stone hit him in the forehead, he falls down, and he died. But then it says that David runs to him and kills him. So did he die before he ran to him, or did he run to him and he killed him? So Robert Alter reads it this way, the stone knocked him down, and it described he died, that was the process of him dying, but David had to finish him off. So with Robert Alter's Pirush in mind, I think it's the right Pirush, it's the way to put the text together, so here's what happens. He shoots a slingshot at him. Goliath, which is unstable and heavy, because he has all these arms, all this steel on his body to protect him, which makes him heavy, he collapses. David, as it says, is not heavy. He's light. He runs. uses the moment where he lost balance and he fell. He takes the sword of Goliath and chops his head off. Sorry, this is graphic. It's not me. It's the Tanakh. He chops his head off. David turns the advantages of Goliath being protected to his disadvantage. He's heavy. He takes his disadvantage, being not protected, to his advantage. He's light and quick. But more importantly, he surprises him, knocks him down, runs to him, and kills him with his sword. Now, this is the metaphor. It's more than a metaphor. What David always does, he kills his enemy, uses his enemy's sword. David doesn't use his power against his enemy. He uses the power of his enemy against the enemy. Or better put, he manipulates his enemy to a place where the power of his enemy will lead to the self-destruction of his enemy. That's the story of David and Goliath, and that's a window into the brilliance of David. Isn't the David and Goliath story a microcosm of the David and Shaul story? How does David bring Shaul down? He doesn't attack Shaul. He lets Shaul self-destruct. Shaul brings himself down. What shifted the power from Shaul to David wasn't the power of David using against Shaul, it's the power of Shaul using against David. The power that Shaul used against David is the power that made David king. The power used against him is the power that elevates him. That's what happened with Goliath, that's what happened with Shaul. That is the brilliance of David. Which takes me to the sin of David. If the primary sin of Shaul was with Amalek, the foundational sin of David is with Bathsheba. Now, it's a complicated story, and it's a long story. There's a lot of details in this story. And I'm pretty sure that many of you know the basics of this story. I'm not going to cover this story. But it's a story about David sending his troops to Ammon to fight the enemies. And one of the first times he's not there, he's not with his troops, he's not fighting the enemies. Where is he? He's at home in Jerusalem. With David Yoshev B'Yerushalayim. He's sitting in Jerusalem. And he's a little bit bored. And he looks around. And he sees Bathsheba showering in one of the roofs of Jerusalem. And he asks around, and he learns that Bathsheba is the wife of one of his warriors, Uriah Hitti. That doesn't stop him from sleeping with her. She gets pregnant, and David is worried. We can understand why he's worried. What would happen to his authority, to his moral authority, if the word goes out that while his soldiers are fighting his enemies in his service, he's sleeping with their wives? That will crack his moral authority. David doesn't want that to happen. So he tries to cover it up. After a few failed attempts to cover it up, he comes up with a fatal plan. He gives Yoav an order. Actually, it's more complicated. He writes a letter to Yoav. And he gives Yoav an order. I won't go into detail, but the order is make sure that Uriah dies in the battlefield. By the way, who's supposed to hand over to Yoav that letter, the letter of where Yoav is instructed to destroy Uriah in the battlefield? Uriah himself. He has to hand over to Yoav, David's general, in the battle with Ammon, a letter of self-destruction. So there is a sin. He sleeps with the wife of one of his soldiers. And there's the cover-up. But the cover-up is the sin. Is the greater sin, where he orders Yoav to have Uriah killed by the Ammonim, by the Ammonites, I guess you call it. So after this horrible sin cover-up, and the cover-up is the sin, avera, goreret, avera, sin leads to sin. I think the first sin is he didn't go to the battlefield, he stayed at home in Jerusalem. A sin leads to a sin, leads to a sin. After a while, Natan, the prophet, comes to him. And he says to him, he leads David to say, Chatati Lehashem. Like Shaul owned his sin, David owns his sin, he confesses. But then, Natan says to David the following line. Now remember, when prophets, when Shmuel delivered his prophecy to Shaul about his punishment, Re'echa Tov Mimcha, it was enigmatic. What does it mean, Re'echa Tov Mimcha? Also, when Natan tells the punishment of David, he's enigmatic. Let's listen to the words. Ko Amar Adonai, says the prophet Natan to David, where the punishment is going to be for sin with Bathsheba and Uriah. Ko Amar Adonai, Hineni Mekim Alecha Ra'a Mi Beitecha. I'm going to bring upon you Ra'a. Ra'a is bad. Something bad. From where? From within your home. Again, enigmatic, but we have a flavor of what this might look like. Ra'a mi betecha. Velakachti et neshecha le'einecha venatati le're'echa. I will take your wives, your women, and I'm handing them over to re'echa. And he will sleep with them. Veshachav im neshecha le'einei ha'shemesh hazot. Remember how Shaul was trying to figure out, what does it mean, Re'echa tov mimcha? Now David has a line planted in his head. The line is, Lakachti et neshecha le'enecha, venatati le'echa. I'll take your wives, I'll hand them over to your Re'echa. Re'echa is back, to someone close to you. And what will he do? He will sleep with them under the sun. Okay. Now, what is the meaning of this line? And what's more important, how did David understand this line? So for us modern people, it seems like someone is going to come and sleep with his wives, right? That's what it says. Someone close, right? Lakachti et neshecha le'enecha v'natati le're'echa. I will take your wives and hand them over to your re'ah, to someone close to you. That's the pshat. But I think David sees it differently. Because text, the meaning of a text comes from the context. If I say in biblical times, someone will say to someone 3,000 years ago, break a leg, it means he's hoping that that person will be injured. If Lanita will say to me, before I start lecturing, break a leg, she doesn't want me to be injured, she wants me to have good luck. The meaning of words is defined by the cultural context when they're said. In today's world, if you say to someone, someone's going to sleep with your wife, you're saying, who is that jerk, that immoral person that wants to sleep with a married man's wife? But in biblical times, it means all that, but it means has another layer. It means something else also. It means when you're a king and someone else is going to sleep with your wife, it means he is going to be king. That's what it means in biblical times. Now, just to show, I don't have time to prove this. So if anybody's skeptical here, I'm going to give you two sources so you can check this out. One source is Kings 2, chapter 2, verse 22. How when Adoniah ben Chagit wanted to sleep with one of the wives of David, King Solomon says, you want to be king. Sleeping with the wife of the king is declaring that you are rebelling against the king and you want to be king. Another moment of this is Samuel 2, chapter 3, from starting verse 6, verse 7, we see the same dynamics. Sleeping with the wife of the king is a declaration. From now on, I am king. It's unethical. It's a patriarchal society. It's not our society. It's not our values. That's how it was in the ancient world. Sleeping with the wife of the king doesn't mean you only slept with the wife. It wasn't only sensual. It was also political. It means now you're owning the power. Now you're the king. That was a metaphor. That was a living metaphor in a patriarchal ancient society. And we could be judgmental of it for good reasons, but now I don't want to be judgmental. I just want to have clarity. I want to understand the text. And according to this text, the context of this text, given the context of this text, when Natan says ולקחתי את נשיך לעיניך ונתתי לרעיך. When he says that to him, it has two meanings. It means some jerk is going to sleep with your wife. It also means someone is going to take over your kingdom. And I think David has in mind those, the double meaning of the prophecy of Nathan. And with that in mind, that might explain very peculiar behavior of David from this moment on. And I want to notice three very bizarre behaviors that create a pattern of behavior of David. Number one, there'll be a moment, it's a long story, but I'm cutting to the chase to three moments that create a pattern. One moment is his son Avshalom, that has a story of his own that we're not going to go into, stands outside of the palace, dressed up in the uniform of the king. What does that mean? We know what it means. Biblically, it means we see something similar in the beginning of Book Kings 1 with Adoniah ben Chagit. When you dress up like a king, that's a declaration. I want to be king. I'm planning to be king. And when you do that, when the real king is alive, that could be an act of rebellion. That's what Avshalom does. He dresses up like a king. He takes and he acts like a king. And people go in and out of the palace. Now, anyone that goes in the palace and interacts with the king many times comes out upset and not satisfied. Because the king can't satisfy everyone. Some people will leave the office of the king happy. He got what they want. Most people don't get what they want because resources are limited. What does Avshalom do? He goes to all the people that didn't get what they want from the king and he says to them, when I am king, you'll get exactly what you wanted. That's a good politician. Spread promises. When I'm in charge, you'll get whatever you want. It says he's stealing the heart of the people. He is making himself popular. He is behaving like a king. What did David do while Avshalom was behaving this way? While he was stealing the heart of the people? While he is dressed of the king? While he is criticizing the decisions of the king and saying, if I am king, I would be nicer to you. I would please you. I will satisfy everything that you want. What does David do? He does absolutely nothing. That's one moment. Next moment, Avshalom, after gaining all this cheap popularity, because that's what politicians do, it's cheap popularity, to say, when I'm king, you'll get what you want. Of course, promises cost nothing. That's cheap popularity. Avshalom asks David permission to go to Hebron. David gives him permission. Avshalom goes to Hebron, and what does he do? He declares himself king. And he declares a rebellion against David. And he takes his army that he's just built, and he starts charging from Hebron to Jerusalem. David hears about this. He gets the intelligence. He sent Avshalom to Hebron. He ignored all the warnings. He sent Avshalom to Hebron. Avshalom declares himself king in Hebron, and now Avshalom is now charging Jerusalem. How does David respond? He runs away. Second bizarre moment, so not typical of David. He takes everything he has. He takes all his people. And he runs and he escapes. This is a David. He was the only one that had the courage to confront Goliath. He's always the one in front of his soldiers. He runs away. But the third bizarre moment is that when he runs away, He does keep in the palace a small force that will protect the palace. And who is commanded to stay in the palace and protect it? The 10 wives of David. Actually, it's not wives, it's pilagshim. How do you say pilagshim?
Concubines.
How?
Concubines.
Concubines? The 10 concubines, he keeps them. For what? Lishmor habayit. Maybe they know karate or something, and they will protect the palace from Avshalom and his troops. He ignores the signs. When Avshalom lives, when Avshalom starts making himself popular and starts to challenge the sovereignty of David, he escapes Jerusalem, untypical, and the force that's there to protect the palace are his
concubines.
His, let's call him Neshecha, his woman. Why does he do this? Why does he do this? Now, first of all, what happens in the meantime? David escapes, Avshalom comes into Jerusalem, and he has a very wise advisor. And his wise advisor said, okay, the palace is empty. There's David's 10 women here. The first thing you do, you take them up to the roof and sleep with them. So all the people of Israel, what will they see? They will see that you are the king. Again, I said, that's how you declare power. What the readers know is that by doing that, the two layers of the prophecy of Natan are now completed, are now fulfilled. Re'echa, Avshalom's son, sleeps with his women and becomes the king. The two layers of Natan's prophecy become a reality. Why did David behave this way? We have two windows into his mindset while he escapes. He escapes, he goes down through Nahal Kidron. In the end, he crosses the Jordan Valley. He goes to the eastern bank of the Jordan River. And there he gathers his troops. And then they enter the next stage of the story. I'll stop here. While he's escaping Jerusalem and crossing the Jordan Valley and goes to the other, to the eastern side of the Jordan River, while he does that, there's two windows to do things he says that enable us to understand his peculiar, his bizarre behavior. One thing is that he bumps into Tzadok and Eviatar, the high priests, and he sees that they want to take the ark with them. While they're fleeing, take the ark with them. David says to them, don't take the ark with you. Keep it in Yerushalayim. Keep it next to the palace. They ask why. He says, I might come back. I might come back, and when I come back, I want the ark to be there. Interesting. This is an interesting window into the way David himself is interpreting his own decision. He sees it as something impermanent. It's temporary. It's short term. I'm leaving in order to come back. That's one insight into David's mind while he is fleeing Jerusalem. Second window is that there is a person called Shim'i ben Gera. Shim'i ben Gera is a Benjaminite. And he starts cursing David. I just want you to capture the power. Vayesakel ba'avanim et David. He starts throwing stones on David. And he curses and all the servants of David. And he says, Tse, tse, ish damim, leave the town, leave the town. You are a murderer, he says to David. Hishiv alecha Adonai kol dmei beit Shaul. God is now returning upon you, but all the bad things you did to the house of Shaul. And he goes on. Now after he's cursing and humiliating and throwing stones on David and humiliating him publicly, so one of David's generals says to him, Avishai, he says to him, how about I approach him and take his head off of his body? And David says to him, Vayomer David el Avishai, Hine bni asher yatsami me'ai mevakeshet nafshi. My son wants to kill me. Ve'af ki ata ben hayamei. Now this guy is cursing me. Hanichu lo ve'yekale. Let him curse me. Let him humiliate me. Ulai yireh Adonai be'oni. Maybe God will see this. Ve'shiv Adonai li tova tachat kila. And God will return a favor for me accepting this public humiliation. This is another window into the way David is experiencing this moment. He feels like this moment needs to happen. We shouldn't fight it. We need to enable it. If right now I'm supposed to be publicly humiliated, let me be publicly humiliated. Let it happen. If this is what's supposed to happen, I want it to happen. I'm not fighting the events. I'm enabling them to unfold. Let's put this together. On the one hand, he understands this isn't permanent. This moment where he's fleeing and he's powerless and he's chased by his son, it's impermanent. On the other hand, he says, this is a process that I have to go through. It has to happen. So it has to happen, and it's impermanent. I am going to let it happen, but I'm going to be back. Maybe he's thinking, only if I will let it happen, if I will let it happen, it will end and I will be back. Let it happen is to let Avshalom pretend he's king, putting on the uniform. Let it happen is to let Avshalom to go to Hebron and rebel against him. Let it happen is to keep the concubines, is to keep the women in the palace. Let it happen. I think this is David's mindset. David is not fighting the prophecy of Nathan. He is actively fulfilling the prophecy of Nathan. When he keeps the women there, it's almost like he's asking for the prophecy of Nathan to fulfill itself. Where he lets Avshalom rebel against him, he is almost inviting the prophecy of Nathan to fulfill itself. When Shaul heard about the prophecy of Shmuel, he tried to fight the prophecy. David is not fighting against the prophecy of Nathan. He's letting it happen. But he's letting it happen, and maybe even on his own initiative, he's pushing it to become a reality on his own terms. This is what David understands. The best way to neutralize a bomb is to let it explode. Because once it explodes, it can't explode again. Once Natan's prophecy is a reality, Avshalom sleeps with the woman, becomes king, the prophecy is a reality, David gathers up his troops, they fight back. It's a tragic battle. Avshalom dies. David didn't want that to happen. He fights back, and in the end, he's back on his throne, back on his palace. This is the difference between Shaul and David. They both sinned. They both heard prophecies that the meaning of the prophecy, the way they understood it, is that someone else will replace them in power. Shaul fights the prophecy. David fulfills the prophecy. But what happens, everything that Shaul did to fight the prophecy made the prophecy, turned the prophecy into a reality. David is the other way around. By fulfilling the prophecy, he's escaping the prophecy and guaranteeing that he is back and he is king. So we have two prophecies, both fulfilled. Shaul, by escaping the prophecy, is fulfilling the prophecy. David, by fulfilling the prophecy, is escaping the prophecy. The meaning of this difference, I think, is very deep. What do we do when we know that something big is going to happen? Do we fight it or do we let it happen? We learn from Shaul that when you fight what's going to happen anyway, you're going to let what's going to happen crush you. But David is not fighting his destiny. By enabling it to happen, he liberates himself from what was going to happen. The difference between Shaul and David, the way they both respond to prophecy, makes a psychological difference. There's a psychological difference here. There's a theological difference here. We'll touch and we'll think about these issues in our last session.